"Get a bomb up here!" Lawrence snapped to Granby. They would have to try and hurl one into the Chevalier's belly rigging, despite the danger of missing and striking Tamerere or Lily. Tamerere kept slashing away in a blind passion, his sides belling out for breath. He roared so tremendously that his body vibrated with the force, and Lawrence's ears ached. The Chevalier shuddered with pain. Somewhere on his other side, Maximus also roared, blocked from Lawrence's sight by the French dragon's bulk. The attack had its effect. The Chevalier bellowed in his deep, hoarse voice, and his claws sprang free.
"Cut loose!" Lawrence shouted. "Temeraire, cut loose!
Get between him and Lily!" In answer, Temeraire pulled himself free and dropped. Lily was moaning, streaming blood, and she was losing elevation rapidly. Having driven off the Chevalier was not enough. The other dragons were now as great a danger to her until she could get back aloft into fighting position. Lawrence heard Captain Harcourt calling orders whose words he could not make out. Abruptly, Lily's belly rigging fell away like a great net sinking down through the clouds, and bombs, supplies, baggage, all went tumbling down and vanished into the waters of the channel below. Her ground crew were all tying themselves to the main harness instead. Thus lightened, Lily shuddered and made a great effort, beating back up into the sky. The wounds were being packed with white bandages, but even at a distance Lawrence could see she would need stitching. Maximus had the Chevalier engaged, but the Pêcheur Coronet and the Fleur de Nuit were falling into a small wedge formation, with the other French middleweight preparing to take a dash at Lily again. Temeraire maintained position just above Lily and hissed threateningly, his bloody claws flexing. But she was climbing too slowly. The battle had turned into a wild melee. Though the other British dragons had now recovered from their initial fright, they were in no sort of order. Harcourt was wholly occupied with Lily's difficulties, and the last French dragon, a Pêcheuret, was fighting Messoria far below. Clearly the French had identified Sutton as the commander and were keeping him out of the way, a strategy Lawrence could grimly admire. He had no authority to take command. He was the most junior captain in the party, but something had to be done.
"Turner!"
he said, catching his signal ensign's attention, but before he gave any order the other British dragons were already wheeling around and in motion.
"Signal, sir! Form up around leader!"
Turner said, pointing. Lawrence looked back and saw Precursoris swinging into Maximus's usual place with signal flags waving. Not being limited to the formation's pace, Choiseul and the big dragon had gone on ahead of them, but his lookouts had evidently caught sight of the battle, and he had now returned. Lawrence tapped Temeraire's shoulder to draw his attention to the signal.
"I see it,"
Temeraire called back, and at once back-winged and settled into his proper position. Another signal flashed out, and Lawrence brought Temeraire up and in closer. Nitidus also pulled in more tightly, and together they closed the gap in the formation where Messoria would normally have been. "Formation, rise together," the next signal came, and with the other dragons around her, Lily took heart and was able to beat up more strongly. The bleeding had stopped at last. The trio of French dragons had separated. They could no longer hope to succeed with a collective charge, not straight into Lily's jaws, and the formation would be up to the level of the Chevalier in a moment. "Maximus, break away!" the signal flashed. Maximus was still engaged in close quarters with the Chevalier, and rifles were cracking away on both sides. The great regal copper gave a final slash of his claws and pushed away. Just a fraction too soon, for the formation was not yet high enough, and another few moments were necessary before Lily would be able to strike. The Chevalier's crew now saw his fresh danger, and sent the big dragon back aloft, a great deal of shouting going on aboard in French. Though he was bleeding from many wounds, the Chevalier was so large that these did not hamper him severely, and he was still able to climb quicker than the injured Lily. After a moment, Choiseul signalled, "Formation, hold elevation," and they gave up the pursuit. The French dragons came together at a distance into a loose cluster, wheeling around as they considered their next attack. But then they all turned as one and fled rapidly northeast, the Pêcheuret disengaging from Messoria also. Temeraire's lookouts were all calling out and pointing to the south, and when Lawrence looked over his shoulder, he saw 10 dragons flying towards them at great speed, British signals flashing out from the long wing in the lead. The long wing was indeed Excidium. He and his formation accompanied them along the rest of the journey to the Dover covert, the two heavyweight checkered nettles among them taking it in turn to support Lily on the way. She was making reasonable progress, but her head was drooping, and she made a very heavy landing, her legs trembling so that the crew only barely managed to scramble off before she crumpled to the ground. Captain Harcourt's face was streaked with unashamed tears, and she ran to Lily's head and stood there caressing her and murmuring loving encouragement while the surgeons began their work. Lawrence directed Temeraire to land on the very edge of the covert's landing ground, so the injured dragons might have more room. Maximus, Immortalis, and Messoria had all taken painful, if not dangerous, wounds in the battle, though nothing like what Lily had suffered, and their low cries of pain were very difficult to hear. Lawrence repressed a shudder and stroked Temeraire's sleek neck. He was deeply grateful for Temeraire's quickness and grace, which had preserved him from the other's fate.
"Mr. Granby, let us unload at once, and then, if you please, let us see what we can spare for the comfort of Lily's crew. They have no baggage left, it looks to me."
"Very good, sir," Granby said, turning to give the orders at once. It took several hours to settle the dragons down and get them unpacked and fed. Fortunately, the covert was a very large one, covering perhaps 100 acres when including the cattle pastures, and there was no difficulty about finding a comfortably large clearing for Temeraire. Temeraire was wavering between excitement at having seen his first battle and deep anxiety for Lily's sake. For once he ate only indifferently, and Lawrence finally told the crew to take away the remainder of the carcasses.
"We can hunt in the morning. There is no need to force yourself to eat," he said.
"Thank you. I truly do not feel very hungry at the moment," Temeraire said, settling down his head.
He was quiet while they cleaned him, until the crewmen had gone and left him alone with Lawrence. His eyes were closed to slits, and for a moment Lawrence wondered if he had fallen asleep. Then he opened them a little more and asked softly,
"Lawrence, is it always so, after a battle?"
Lawrence did not need to ask what he meant. Temeraire's weariness and sorrow were apparent. It was hard to know how to answer. He wanted so very much to reassure, yet he himself was still tense and angry, and while the sensation was familiar, its lingering was not. He had been in many actions, no less deadly or dangerous, but this one had differed in the crucial respect. When the enemy took aim at his charge, they were threatening not his ship, but his dragon, already the dearest creature to him in the world. Nor could he contemplate injury to Lily, or Maximus, or any of the members of the formation with any sort of detachment. They might not be his own Temeraire, but they were full comrades in arms as well. It was not at all the same, and the surprise attack had caught him unprepared in his mind.
"It is often difficult afterwards, I am afraid, particularly when a friend has been injured, or perhaps killed," he said finally. "I will say that I find this action especially hard to bear. There was nothing to be gained, for our part, and we did not seek it out."
"Yes, that is true,"
Temeraire said, his ruff drooping low upon his neck.
"It would be better if I could think we had all fought so hard, and Lily had been hurt, for some purpose, but they only came to hurt us, so we did not even protect anyone."
"That is not true at all. You protected Lily," Lawrence said. "And consider, the French made a very clever and skilful attack, taking us wholly by surprise, with a force equal to our own in numbers and superior in experience, and we defeated it and drove them off. That is something to be proud of, is it not?"
"I suppose that is true," Temeraire said. His shoulders settled as he relaxed. "If only Lily will be all right," he added.
"Let us hope so. Be sure that all that can be done for her will be," Lawrence said, stroking his nose. "Come now, you must be tired. Will you not sleep? Shall I read to you a little?"
"I do not think I can sleep," Temeraire said. "But I would like you to read to me, and I will lie quietly and rest."
He yawned as soon as he had finished saying this, and was asleep before Lawrence had even taken the book out. The weather had finally turned, and the warm, even breaths rising from his nostrils made small puffs of fog in the crisp air. Leaving him to sleep, Lawrence walked quickly back to the covert headquarters. The path through the dragon fields was lit with hanging lanterns, and in any case he could see the windows up ahead. An easterly wind was carrying the salt air in from the harbour, mingled with the coppery smell of the warm dragons already familiar and hardly noticed. He had a warm room on the second floor, with a window that looked out onto the back gardens, and his baggage had already been unpacked. He looked at the wrinkled clothes, ruefully. Evidently the servants at the covert had no more notion of packing than the aviators themselves did. There was a great noise of raised voices as he came into the senior officer's dining room, despite the late hour. The other captains of the formation were assembled at the long table, where their own meal was going largely untouched.
"Is there any word about Lily?" he asked,
taking the empty chair between Berkeley and Dulcia's captain, Chenery. Captain Harcourt and Captain Little of Immortalis were the only ones not present.
"He cut her to the bone, the great coward, but that is all we know," Chenery said. "They are still sewing her up, and she hasn't taken anything to eat."
Lawrence knew that was a bad sign. Injured dragons usually became ravenous unless they were in very great pain.
"Maximus and Masoria?" he asked, looking at Berkeley and Sutton. "Ate well and fast asleep," Berkeley said. His usually placid face was drawn and haggard, and he had a streak of dark blood running across his forehead into his bristly hair.
"That was damned quick of you today, Lawrence. We'd have lost her."
"Not quick enough," Lawrence said quietly, forestalling the murmur of agreement. He had not the least desire to be praised for this day's work, though he was proud of what Temeraire had done.
"Quicker than the rest of us," Sutton said, draining his glass.
From the looks of his cheeks and nose, it was not his first.
"They caught us properly flat-footed, damned frogs. What the devil they were doing to have a patrol there, I would like to know."
"The route from Lagan to Dover isn't much of a secret, Sutton," Little said, coming to the table. They dragged chairs about to make room for him at their end of the table. "Immortalis is settled and eating, by the by. Speaking of which, please give me that chicken here."
He wrenched off a leg with his hands and tore into it hungrily. Looking at him, Lawrence felt the first stirrings of appetite. The other captains seemed to feel the same way, and for the next 10 minutes there was silence while they passed the plates around and concentrated on their food. They had none of them eaten since a hasty breakfast before dawn at the covert near Middlesbrough. The wine was not very good, but Lawrence drank several glasses anyway.
"I expect they've been lurking about between Felixstowe and Dover, just waiting to get a drop on us," Little said after a while,
wiping his mouth and continuing his earlier thought.
"By God, if you ever catch me taking Immortalis that way again. Overland it is for us from now on, unless we're looking for a fight."
"Right you are,"
Chenery said with heartfelt agreement.
"Hello, Choiseul. Pull up a chair."
He shuffled over a little more, and the Royalist captain joined them.
"Gentlemen, I am very happy to say that Lily has begun to eat. I have just come from Captain Harcourt," he said, and raised a glass. "To their health, may I propose?"
"Hear, hear,"
Sutton said, refilling his own glass. They all joined in the toast, and there was a general sigh of relief.
"Here you all are, then. Eating, I hope. Good, very good."
Admiral Lenton had come up to join them. He was the commander-in-chief of the Channel Division, and thus all those dragons at the Dover covert.
"No, don't be fools. Don't get up,"
he said impatiently, as Lawrence and Choiseul began to rise, and the others belatedly followed.
"After the day you've had, for heaven's sake. Here, pass that bottle over, Sutton. So, you all know that Lily is eating. Yes, the surgeons hope she will be flying short distances in a couple of weeks. And in the meantime, you have at least nicely mauled a couple of their heavy combat beasts. A toast to your formation, gentlemen."
Lawrence was at last beginning to feel his tension and distress ease. Knowing Lily and the others were out of danger was a great relief, and the wine had loosened the tight knot in his throat. The others seemed to feel much the same way, and conversation grew slow and fragmented. They were all much inclined to nod over their cups.
"I am quite certain that the Grand Chevalier was triumphalis,"
Choiseul was telling Admiral Lenton quietly.
"I have seen him before. He is one of France's most dangerous fighters. He was certainly at the Dijon covert near the Rhine when Precursoris and I left Austria. And I must represent to you, sir, that it bears out all my worst fears. Bonaparte would not have brought him here if he was not wholly confident of victory against Austria, and I am sure more of the French dragons are on their way to assist Villeneuve."
"I was inclined to agree with you before, Captain. I am sure of it," Lenton said. "But for the moment, all we can do is hope Mortiferous reaches Nelson before the French dragons reach Villeneuve, and that he can do the job. We cannot spare Exidium if we do not have Lily. I would not be surprised if that was what they intended by this strike. It is the clever sort of way that damned Corsican thinks."
Lawrence could not help thinking of the Reliant, perhaps even now under the threat of a full-scale French aerial attack, and the other ships of the great fleet currently blockading Cadiz. So many of his friends and acquaintances. Even if the French dragons did not arrive first, there would be a great naval battle to be fought, and how many would be lost without his ever hearing another word from them? He had not devoted much time to correspondence in the last busy months. Now he regretted the neglect deeply.
"Have we had any dispatches from the blockade at Cadiz?" he asked. "Have they seen any action?"
"Not that I've heard of," Lenton said. "Oh, that's right, you're our fellow from the Navy, aren't you? Well, I will be starting those of you with uninjured beasts on patrolling over the Channel Fleet anyway while the others recover. You can touch down for a bit by the flagship and hear the news. They'll be damn glad to see you. We haven't been able to spare anyone long enough to bring them the post in a month."
"Will you want us tomorrow, then?"
Chenery asked, stifling a yawn, not entirely successfully.
"No, I can spare you a day. See to your dragons and enjoy the rest while it lasts," Lenton said with a sharp, braying laugh. "I'll be having you rousted out of bed at dawn the day after."
Temeraire slept very heavily and late the next morning, leaving Lawrence to occupy himself for some hours after breakfast. He met Berkeley at the table and walked back with him to see Maximus. The regal copper was still eating, a procession of fresh, slaughtered sheep going down his gullet one after another, and he only rumbled a wordless, mouthful greeting as they came to the clearing. Berkeley brought out a bottle of rather terrible wine and drank most of it himself, while Lawrence sipped at his glass to be polite, as they told over the battle again, with diagrams scratched in the dirt and pebbles representing the dragons.
"We would do very well to add a light flyer, a grayling if one can be spared, to fly lookout above the formation," Berkeley said, sitting back heavily upon a rock. "It is all our big dragons being young. When the big ones panic in that way, the little ones will have a start, even if they know better."
Lawrence nodded. "Although I hope this misadventure will at least have given them some experience in dealing with the fright," he said. "In any event, the French cannot count on having such ideal circumstances often. Without the cloud cover, they should never have managed it."
"Gentlemen, are you looking over the plan of yesterday?"
Choiseul had been walking past towards the headquarters. He joined them and crouched down beside the diagram.
"I am very sorry to have been away at the beginning."
His coat was dusty and his neckcloth was stained badly with sweat. He looked as though he had not shifted his clothes since yesterday, and a thin tracery of red veins stood out in the whites of his eyes. He rubbed his face as he looked down.
"Have you been up all night?" Lawrence asked.
Choiseul shook his head.
"No, but I took it in turns with Catherine, with Harcourt, to sleep a little, by Lily. She would not rest otherwise."
He shut his eyes in an enormous yawn and nearly fell over.
"Merci,"
he said, grateful for Lawrence's steadying hand, and pushed himself slowly to his feet.
"I will leave you. I must get Catherine some food."
"Pray go and get some rest," Lawrence said. "I will bring her something. Temeraire is asleep, and I am at liberty." Harcourt herself was wide awake, pale with anxiety, but steady now, giving orders to the crew and feeding Lily with chunks of still steaming beef from her own hand, a constant stream of encouragement coming from her lips. Lawrence had brought her some bread with bacon. She would have taken the sandwich in her bloody hands, unwilling to interrupt, but he managed to coax her away long enough to wash a little and eat, while a crewman took her place. Lily kept eating with one golden eye resting on Harcourt for reassurance. Choiseul came back before Harcourt had quite finished, his neckcloth and coat gone, and a servant following with a pot of coffee, strong and hot.
"Your lieutenant is looking for you, Lawrence. The Temeraire begins to stir," he said, sitting down again heavily beside her.
"I cannot manage to sleep. The coffee has done me well."
"Thank you, Jean-Paul. If you are not too tired, I would be very grateful for your company," she said, already drinking her second cup. "Pray have no hesitation, Lawrence. I'm sure Temeraire must be anxious. I'm obliged to you for coming."
Lawrence bowed to them both, though he had a sense of awkwardness for the first occasion since he had grown used to Harcourt. She was leaning, with no appearance of consciousness, against Choiseul's shoulder, and he was looking down at her with undisguised warmth. She was quite young, after all, and Lawrence could not help feeling the absence of any suitable chaperone. He consoled himself that nothing could happen, with Lily and the crew present, even if they had not both been so obviously done in. In any case, he could hardly stay under the circumstances, and he hurried away to Temeraire's clearing. The rest of the day he spent gratefully in idleness, seated comfortably in his usual place in the crook of Temeraire's foreleg, and writing letters. He had formed an extensive correspondence while at sea, with all the long hours to fill, and now many of his acquaintance were owed responses. His mother, too, had managed to write him several hasty and short letters, evidently kept from his father's knowledge. At least they were not franked, so Lawrence was obliged to pay to receive them. Having gorged himself to compensate for his lack of appetite the night before, Temeraire then listened to the letters Lawrence was writing, and dictated his own contributions, sending greetings to Lady Allendale and to Riley.
"And do ask Captain Riley to give my best wishes to the crew of the Reliant," he said. "It seems so very long ago, Lawrence, does it not? I have not had fish in months now."
Lawrence smiled at this measure of time.
"A great deal has happened, certainly. It is strange to think it has not even been a year," he said, sealing the envelope and writing the direction. "I only hope they are all well."
It was the last, and he laid it upon the substantial pile with satisfaction. He was a great deal easier in his conscience now.
"Roland," he called,
and she came running up from where the cadets were playing a game of jacks.
"Go take this to the dispatch post," he said, handing her the stack.
"Sir," she said, a little nervously, accepting the letters, "when I am done, might I have liberty for the evening?"
He was startled by the request. Several of the ensigns and midwing men had put in for liberty, and had it granted that they might visit the city, but the idea of a 10-year-old cadet wandering about Dover alone was absurd, even if she were not a girl.
"Would this be for yourself alone, or will you be going with one of the others?" he asked, thinking she might have been invited to join one of the older officers in a respectable excursion.
"No, sir, only for me," she said.
She looked so very hopeful that Lawrence thought for a moment of granting it and taking her himself, but he could not like to leave Temeraire alone to brood over the previous day.
"Perhaps another time, Roland," he said gently. "We will be here in Dover for a long time now, and I promise you will have another opportunity."
"Oh," she said, downcast. "Yes, sir."
She went away, drooping, so that Lawrence felt guilty. Temeraire watched her go and inquired,
"Lawrence, is there something particularly interesting in Dover, and might we go and see it? So many of our crew seem to be making a visit."
"Oh, dear," Lawrence said. He felt rather awkward explaining that the main attraction was the abundance of harbour prostitutes and cheap liquor.
"Well, a city has a great many people in it, and thus various entertainments provided in close proximity," he tried.
"Do you mean such as more books?" Temeraire said. "But I have never seen Dunn or Collins reading, and they were so very excited to be going. They talked of nothing else all yesterday evening."
Lawrence silently cursed the two unfortunate young midwig men for complicating his task, already planning their next week's duties in a vengeful spirit.
"There is also the theatre, and concerts," he said lamely.
But this was carrying concealment too far. The sting of dishonesty was unpleasant, and he could not bear to feel he had been deceitful to Temeraire, who after all was grown now.
"But I am afraid that some of them go there to drink, and keep low company," he said more frankly.
"Oh, you mean whores,"
Temeraire said, startling Lawrence so greatly he nearly fell from his seat.
"I did not know they had those in cities, too. But now I understand."
"Where on earth had you heard of them?"
Lawrence asked, steadying himself. Now relieved of the burden of explanation, he felt irrationally offended that someone else had chosen to enlighten Temeraire.
"Oh, Victoriatus at Lochlagan told me, for I wondered why the officers were going down to the village when they did not have family there," Temeraire said. "But you have never gone. Are you sure you would not like to?" he added, almost hopefully.
"My dear, you must not say such things,"
Lawrence said, blushing and shaking with laughter at the same time.
"It is not a respectable subject for conversation, at all, and if men cannot be prevented from indulging the habit, they at least ought not to be encouraged. I shall certainly speak with Dunn and Collins. They ought not to be bragging about it, and especially not where the ensigns might hear."
"I do not understand," Temeraire said. "Victoriatus said that it was prodigiously nice for men, and also desirable, for otherwise they might like to get married, and that did not sound very pleasant at all.
Although if you very much wished to, I suppose I would not mind."
He made this last speech with very little sincerity, looking at Lawrence sideways as if to gauge the effect. Lawrence's mirth and embarrassment both faded at once. "I'm afraid you have been given some very incomplete knowledge," he said gently. "Forgive me. I ought to have spoken of these matters to you before. I must beg you to have no anxiety. You are my first charge and will always be, even if I should ever marry, and I do not suppose I will." He paused a moment to reflect if speaking further would give Temeraire more worry, but in the end he decided to err on the side of full confidence, and added, "There was something of an understanding between myself and a lady before you came to me, but she has since set me at liberty."
"Do you mean she has refused you?" Temeraire said, very indignantly, by way of demonstrating that dragons might be as contrary as men. "I am very sorry, Lawrence. If you like to get married, I'm sure you can find someone else much nicer."
"That is very flattering, but I assure you I have not the least desire to seek out a replacement," Lawrence said. Temeraire ducked his head a little and made no further demurrals, quite evidently pleased.
"But Lawrence," he said, then halted.
"Lawrence," he asked,
"if it is not a fit subject, does that mean I ought not to speak of it any more?"
"You must be careful to avoid it in any wider company, but you may always speak of anything you like to me," Lawrence said.
"I am merely curious now if that is all there is in Dover," Temeraire said, "for Roland is too young for whores, is she not?"
"I am beginning to feel the need of a glass of wine to fortify myself against this conversation," Lawrence said ruefully. Thankfully, Temeraire was satisfied with some further explanation of what the theatre and concerts might be, and the other attractions of a city. He turned his attention, willingly, to a discussion of the planned route for their patrol, which a runner had brought over that morning, and even inquired about the possibility of catching some fish for dinner. Lawrence was glad to see him so recovered in spirit after the previous day's misfortunes, and had just decided that he would take Roland to the town after all, if Temeraire did not object, when he saw her returning in the company of another captain, a woman. He had been sitting upon Temeraire's foreleg in what he was abruptly conscious was a state of disarray. He hurriedly climbed down on the far side, so that he was briefly hidden by Temeraire's body. There was no time to put back his coat, which was hung over a tree limb some distance away in any case, but he tucked his shirt back into his trousers and tied his neckcloth hastily back round his neck. He came around to make his bow, and nearly stumbled as he saw her clearly. She was not unhandsome, but her face was marred badly by a scar that could only have been made by a sword. The left eye drooped a little at the corner where the blade had just missed it, and the flesh was drawn along an angry red line all the way down her face, fading to a thinner white scar along her neck. She was his own age, or perhaps a little older. The scar made it difficult to tell, but in any case she wore the triple bars which marked her as a senior captain, and a small gold medal of the Nile in her lapel. "Lawrence, is it?" she said, without waiting for any sort of introduction, while he was still busy striving to conceal his surprise. "I am Jane Roland, Exidium's captain. I would take it as a personal favour if I might have Emily for the evening, if she can possibly be spared." She glanced pointedly at the idle cadets and ensigns. Her tone was sarcastic, and she was clearly offended. "I beg your pardon," Lawrence said, realizing his mistake. "I had thought she wanted liberty to visit the town. I did not realize—"
And here he barely caught himself. He was quite sure they were mother and daughter, not only because of the shared name, but also a certain similarity of feature and expression, but he could not simply make the assumption.
"Certainly you may have her," he finished instead.
Hearing his explanation, Captain Roland unbent at once.
"Ha! I see what mischief you must have imagined her getting into," she said. Her laugh was curiously hearty and unfeminine. "Well, I promise I shan't let her run wild, and to have her back by 8 o'clock. Thank you. Exidium and I have not seen her in almost a year, and we are in danger of forgetting what she looks like."
Lawrence bowed and saw them off. Roland, hurrying to keep up with her mother's long, mannish stride, speaking the whole time in obvious excitement and enthusiasm, and waving her hand towards her friends as she went away. Watching them go, Lawrence felt a little foolish. He had at last grown used to Captain Harcourt, and should have been able to draw the natural conclusion. Exidium was, after all, another Longwing. Presumably he, too, insisted on a female captain, just as did Lily, and with his many years of service, his captain could scarcely have avoided battle. Yet Lawrence had to own he was surprised, and not a little shocked, to see a woman so cut about, and so forward.
Harcourt, his only other example of a female captain, was by no means missish, but she was still quite young and conscious of her early promotion, which perhaps made her less assured. With the subject of marriage so fresh in his mind after his discussion with Temeraire, he also could not help wondering about Emily's father. If marriage was an awkward proposition for a male aviator, it seemed nearly inconceivable for a female one. The only thing he could imagine was that Emily was natural-born, and as soon as the idea occurred to him, he scolded himself to be entertaining such thoughts about a perfectly respectable woman he had just met. But his involuntary guess proved entirely correct in the event.
"I'm afraid I have not the slightest idea. I have not seen him in 10 years, she said, later that evening.
She had invited him to join her for a late supper at the officers' club after bringing Emily back, and after a few glasses of wine he had not been able to resist making a tentative inquiry after the health of Emily's father.
"It is not as though we were married, you know. I do not believe he even knows Emily's name."
She seemed wholly unconscious of any shame, and after all, Lawrence had privately felt any more legitimate situation would have been impossible. But he was uncomfortable, nevertheless. Thankfully, though she noticed, she did not take any offence at it for herself, but rather said kindly,
"I dare say our ways are still odd to you, but you can marry if you like. It is not held against you at all in the corps. It is only that it is rather hard on the other person, always taking second place to a dragon. For my own part, I have never felt anything wanting. I should never have desired children if it were not for Ixidium's sake, although Emily is a dear, and I am very happy to have her, but it was sadly inconvenient for all that."
"So Emily is to follow you as his captain?" Lawrence said.
"May I ask you, are the dragons, the long-lived ones, I mean, always inherited this way?" "When we can manage it. They take it very hard, you see, losing a handler, and they are more likely to accept a new one if it is someone they have some connection to, and whom they feel shares their grief," she said. "So we breed ourselves as much as them. I expect they will be asking you to manage one or two for the corps yourself."
"Good Lord," he said, startled by the idea. He had discarded the thought of children with his plans of marriage from the very moment of Edith's refusal, and still further gone now that he was aware of Temeraire's objections. He could not immediately imagine how he might arrange the matter.
"I suppose it must be rather shocking to you, poor fellow. I am sorry," she said. "I would offer, but you ought to wait until he is at least 10 years old, and in any case I cannot be spared just now."
Lawrence required a moment to understand what she meant. Then he snatched up his wine-glass with an unsteady hand, and endeavoured to conceal his face behind it. He could feel colour rising in his cheeks, despite all the will in the world to prevent it.
"Very kind," he said into the cup, strangled half between mortification and laughter.
It was not the sort of offer he had ever envisioned receiving, even if it had only half been made.
"Catherine might do for you by then, however," Roland went on, still in that appallingly practical tone. "That might do nicely, indeed. You could have one each, for Lily and Temeraire."
"Thank you," he said very firmly, in desperation, trying to change the subject. "May I bring you a glass of something to drink?"
"Oh, yes, port would be splendid, thank you," she said.
By this time he was beyond being shocked, and when he returned with two glasses and she offered him an already lit cigar, he shared it with her willingly. He stayed talking with her for several hours more, until they were the only ones left in the club and the servants were beginning to pointedly stop concealing their yawns. They climbed the stairs together.
"It is not so very late as all that," she said, looking at the handsome great clock at the end of the upper landing. "Are you very tired? We might have a hand or two of piquet in my rooms."
By this time he had begun to be so easy with her that he thought nothing of the suggestion. When he left her at last, very late, to return to his own rooms, a servant was walking down the hall and glanced at him. Only then did he consider the propriety of his behaviour and suffer a qualm. But the damage, if any, had already been done. He put it from his mind, and sought his bed at last. Chapter 10. He was sufficiently experienced to no longer be very surprised the next morning, when he found that their late night had led to no gossip. Instead, Captain Roland hailed him warmly at breakfast, and introduced him to her lieutenants without the slightest consciousness, and they walked out to their dragons together. Lawrence saw Temeraire finishing off a hearty breakfast of his own, and took a moment to have a private and forceful word with Collins and Dunn about their indiscretion. He did not mean to go on like a blue light captain, preaching chastity and temperance all day. Still, he did not think it prudish if he preferred his youngsters to have a respectable example before them in the older officers.
"If you must keep such company, I do not propose to have you making whoremongers of yourselves, and giving the ensigns and cadets the notion that this is how they ought to behave," he said,
while the two midwing men squirmed. Dunn even opened his mouth and looked as though he would rather like to protest, but subsided under Lawrence's very cold stare. That was a degree of insubordination he did not intend to permit. But having finished the lecture and dismissed them to their work, he found himself a trifle uneasy as he recalled that his own behaviour of the previous night was not above reproach. He consoled himself by the reminder that Roland was a fellow officer. Her company could hardly be compared to that of Hawes, and in any case they had not created any sort of public spectacle, which was at the heart of the matter. However, the rationalization rang a little hollow, and he was glad to distract himself with work. Emily and the two other runners were already waiting by Temeraire's side with the heavy bags of post that had accumulated for the blockading fleet. The very strength of the British fleet left the ships on the blockade in strangely isolated circumstances. It was rarely necessary for a dragon to be sent to their assistance. They received all but their most urgent dispatches and supplies by frigate, and so had little opportunity to hear recent news or receive their post. The French might have 21 ships in Brest, but they did not dare come out to face the far more skilled British sailors. Without naval support, even a full French heavy combat wing would not risk a strafing run, with the sharpshooters always ready in the tops and the harpoon and pepper guns primed upon the deck. Occasionally there might be an attack at night, usually made by a single nocturnal breed dragon, but the riflemen often gave as good as they got in such circumstances, and if a full-scale attack were ever launched, a flare signal could easily be seen by the patrolling dragons to the north. Admiral Lenton had decided to reorder the uninjured dragons of Lily's formation as necessary from day to day, to both keep the dragons occupied and patrol a somewhat greater extent. Today he had ordered Temeraire to fly point, with Nitidus and Dulcia flanking him. They would trail Exidium's formation on the first leg of Channel patrol, then break off for a pass over the main squadron of the Channel fleet, currently just off Ushant and blockading the French port of Brest. Aside from the more martial benefits, their visit would furnish the ships of the fleet with at least a little break in the lonely monotony of their blockade duty. The morning was so cold and crisp, no fog had gathered, the sky sharply brilliant and the water below almost black. Squinting against the glare, Lawrence would have liked to imitate the ensigns and midwing men who were rubbing black coal under their eyes, but as point leader he would be in command of the small group while they were detached, and he would likely be asked aboard to see Admiral Lord Gardiner when they landed at the flagship. Thanks to the weather, it was a pleasant flight, even if not a very smooth one. Wind currents seemed to vary unpredictably once they had moved out over the open water, and Temeraire followed some unconscious instinct in rising and falling to catch the best wind. After an hour's patrol, they reached the point of separation. Captain Roland raised a hand in farewell as Temeraire angled away south and swept past Exidium. The sun was nearly straight overhead, and the ocean glittered beneath them.
"Lawrence, I see the ships ahead," Temeraire said, perhaps half an hour later,
and Lawrence lifted his telescope, having to cup a hand around his eye and squint against the sun before he could see the sails on the water.
"Well sighted," Lawrence called back, and said, "Give them the private signal, if you please, Mr. Turner."
The signal ensign began running up the pattern of flags that would mark them as a British party. Less of a formality in their case, thanks to Temeraire's unusual appearance. Shortly they were sighted and identified. The leading British ship fired a handsome salute of 9 guns, more perhaps than was strictly due to Temeraire, as he was not an official formation leader. Whether it was misunderstanding or generosity, Lawrence was pleased by the attention, and had the riflemen fire off a return salute as they swept by overhead. The fleet was a stirring sight, with the lean and elegant cutters already leaping across the water to cluster around the flagship in anticipation of the post, and the great ships of the line tacking steadily into the northerly wind to keep their positions, white sails brilliant against the water, colours flying in proud display from every mainmast. Lawrence could not resist leaning forward to watch over Temeraire's shoulder, so far that the carabiner straps drew taut. "Signal from the flagship, sir," Turner said, as they drew near enough for the flags to be readable. "Captain, come aboard on landing." Lawrence nodded, no less than he had anticipated.
"Pray acknowledge, Mr. Turner. Mr. Granby, I think we will do a pass over the rest of the fleet to the south while they make ready for us."
The crew of the Hibernia and the neighbouring Agincourt had begun casting out the floating platforms that would be lashed together to form a landing surface for the dragons, and a small cutter was already moving among them, gathering up the tow lines. Lawrence knew from experience that the operation required some time, and would go no quicker with the dragons circling directly overhead. By the time they had completed their sweep and returned, the platforms were ready.
"Bellman up above, Mr. Granby!"
Lawrence ordered. The crew of the lower rigging quickly came scrambling up onto Temeraire's back. The last few sailors hastily cleared off the deck as Temeraire made his descent, with Nitidus and Dulcia following close upon him. The platform bobbed and sank lower in the water as Temeraire's great weight came upon it, but the lashings held secure. Nitidus and Dulcia landed at opposite corners once Temeraire had settled himself, and Lawrence swung himself down.
"Runners, bring the post!"
he said, and himself took the sealed envelope of dispatches from Admiral Lenton to Admiral Gardner. Lawrence climbed easily into the waiting cutter, while his runners, Roland, Dyer, and Morgan, hurried to hand the bags of post over to the outstretched hands of the sailors. He went to the stern. Temeraire was sprawled low to better preserve the balance of the platform, with his head resting upon the edge of the platform very close to the cutter, much to the discomfort of that vessel's crew.
"I will return presently," Lawrence told him. "Pray give Lieutenant Granby the word if you require anything."
"I will, but I do not think I will need to. I am perfectly well," Temeraire answered, to startled looks from the cutter's crew, which only increased as he added, "But if we could go hunting afterwards, I would be glad of it. I am sure I saw some splendid large tunnies on our way."
The cutter was an elegant, clean-lined vessel, and she bore Lawrence to the Hibernia at a pace which he would once have thought the height of speed. Now he stood looking out along her bowsprit, running before the wind, and the breeze in his face seemed barely anything. They had rigged a boatswain's chair over the Hibernia's side, which Lawrence ignored with disdain. His sea legs had scarcely deserted him, and in any case, climbing up the side presented him with no difficulty. Captain Bedford was waiting to greet him, and started in open surprise as Lawrence climbed aboard. They had served together in the Goliath at the Nile.
"Good Lord, Lawrence, I had no notion of your being here in the Channel," he said, formal greeting forgotten, and meeting him instead with a hearty handshake. "Is that your beast, then?" he asked, staring across the water at Temeraire, who was in his bulk not much smaller than the 74-gun Agincourt behind him. "I thought he had only just hatched a 6-month gone."
Lawrence could not help a swelling pride. He hoped that he concealed it as he answered,
"Yes, that is Temeraire. He's not yet 8 months old, yet he does have nearly his full growth."
With difficulty he restrained himself from boasting further. Nothing, he was sure, could be more irritating, like one of those men who could not stop talking of the beauty of their mistress, or the cleverness of their children. In any case, Temeraire did not require praising. Any observer looking at him could hardly fail to mark his distinctive and elegant appearance.
"Oh, I see,"
Bedford said, looking at him with a bemused expression. Then the lieutenant at Bedford's shoulder coughed meaningfully. Bedford glanced at the fellow and then said,
"Forgive me, I was so taken aback to see you that I have been keeping you standing about. Pray come this way. Lord Gardner is waiting to see you."
Admiral Lord Gardner had only lately come to his position as commander in the Channel on Sir William Cornwallis's retirement. The strain of following so successful a leader in so difficult a position was telling upon him. Lawrence had served in the Channel fleet several years before as a lieutenant. They had never been introduced previously, but Lawrence had seen him several times, and his face was markedly aged.
"Yes, I see. Lawrence, is it?"
Gardner said as the flag lieutenant presented him, and murmured a few words which Lawrence could not hear.
"Pray be seated. I must read these dispatches at once, and then I have a few words to give you to carry back for me to Lenton," he said, breaking the seal and studying the contents.
Lord Gardner grunted and nodded to himself as he read through the messages. From his sharp look, Lawrence knew when he reached the account of the recent skirmish.
"Well, Lawrence, "'You have already seen some sharp action, I gather,'
he said, laying aside the papers at last.
"'It is just as well for you all to get some seasoning, I expect. "'It cannot be long before we see something more from them, "'and you must tell Lenton so for me. "'I have been sending every sloop and brig and cutter I dare to risk "'close in to the shore, "'and the French are busy as bees inland outside Cherbourg. "'We cannot tell with what precisely, "'but they can hardly be preparing for anything but invasion, "'and judging by their activity, they mean it to be soon.'
"'Surely, Bonaparte cannot have more news of the fleet in Cadiz than do we,' Lawrence said, disturbed by this intelligence. The degree of confidence augured by such preparations was frighteningly high, and though Bonaparte was certainly arrogant, his arrogance had rarely proven to be wholly unfounded.
"'Not of immediate events, no. Of that I am now thankfully certain. You have brought me confirmation that our dispatch riders have been coming back and forth steadily,'
Gardiner said, tapping the sheaf of papers on his desk.
"'However, we cannot be so wild as to imagine he can come across without his fleet, and that suggests he expects them soon.'
Lawrence nodded. That expectation might still be ill-founded or wishful, but that Bonaparte had it at all meant Nelson's fleet was in imminent danger. Gardiner sealed the packet of returning dispatches and handed them over.
"'There. I am much obliged to you, Lawrence, and for your bringing the post to us. Now I trust you will join us for dinner, and of course your fellow captains as well.'
he said, rising from his desk.
"'Captain Briggs of the Agincourt will join us as well, I think.'
A lifetime of naval training had inculcated in Lawrence the precept that such an invitation from a superior officer was as good as a command, and though Gardiner was no longer strictly his superior, it remained impossible to even think of refusing. But Lawrence could not help but consider Temeraire with some anxiety, and Natidus with even more. The Pascal's Blue was a nervous creature who required a great deal of careful management from Captain Warren under ordinary circumstances, and Lawrence was certain that he would be distressed at the prospect of remaining aboard the makeshift floating platform without his handler and no officer above the rank of lieutenant anywhere to be seen. And yet dragons did wait under such conditions all the time. If there had been a greater aerial threat against the fleet, several might even have been stationed upon platforms at all times, with their captains frequently called upon to join the naval officers in planning. Lawrence could not like subjecting the dragons to such a wait for no better cause than a dinner engagement, but neither could he honestly say there was any actual risk to them.
"'Sir, nothing could give me greater pleasure, and I am sure I speak for Captain Warren and Captain Chenery as well,' he said. There was nothing else to be done. Indeed, Gardiner could hardly be said to be waiting for an answer. He had already gone to the door to call in his lieutenant.' However, only Chenery came over in response to the signalled invitation, bearing sincere but mild regrets.
"'Nitidus will fret if he is left alone, you see, so Warren thinks it much better if he does not leave him,'
was all the explanation he offered, made to Gardiner very cheerfully. He seemed unconscious of the deep solecism he was committing. Lawrence privately winced at the startled and somewhat offended looks this procured, not merely from Lord Gardiner, but from the other captains and the flag lieutenant as well, though he could not help but feel relieved. Still, the dinner began awkwardly and continued so. The admiral was clearly oppressed by thoughts of his work, and there were long periods between his remarks. The table would have been a silent and heavy one, save that Chenery was in his usual form, high-spirited and quick to make conversation. And he spoke freely in complete disregard of the naval convention that reserved the right of starting conversation to Lord Gardiner. When addressed directly, the naval officers would pause very pointedly before responding to him, as briefly as possible, before dropping the subject. Lawrence was at first agonized on his behalf, and then began to grow angry. It must have been clear to even the most sensitive temper that Chenery was speaking in ignorance. His chosen subjects were innocuous, and to sit in sullen and reproachful silence seemed to Lawrence a far greater piece of rudeness. Chenery could not help but notice the cold response. As yet he was only beginning to look puzzled, not offended, but that would hardly last. When he gamely tried once more, this time Lawrence deliberately volunteered a reply. The two of them carried the discussion along between them for several minutes, and then Gardiner, his attention drawn from his brown study, glanced up and contributed a remark. The conversation was thus blessed, and the other officers joined in at last. Lawrence made a great effort, and kept the topic running throughout the rest of the meal. What ought to have been a pleasure thus became a chore, and he was very glad when the port was taken off the table and they were invited to step up on deck for cigars and coffee. Taking his cup, he went to stand by the larboard taffrail to better see the floating platform. Temeraire was sleeping quietly, with the sun beating on his scales, one foreleg dangling over the side into the water, and Nitidus and Dulcia were resting against him. Bedford came to stand and look with him, in what Lawrence took as companionable silence. After a moment, Bedford said, "I suppose he is a valuable animal, and we must be glad to have him. But it is appalling you should be chained to such a life, and in such company." Lawrence could not immediately command the power of speech in response to this remark, so full of sincere pity. Half a dozen answers all crowded to his lips. He drew a breath that shook in his throat, and said in a low, savage voice,
"Sir, you will not speak to me in such terms, either of Temeraire or of my colleagues. I wonder that you could imagine such an address acceptable."
Bedford stepped back from his vehemence. Lawrence turned away and left his coffee cup clattering upon the steward's tray.
"Sir, I think we must be leaving," he said to Gardiner,
keeping his voice even.
"As this is Temeraire's first flight along this course, best were we to return before sunset."
"Of course," Gardiner said, offering a hand. "Godspeed, Captain. I hope we will see you again shortly."
Despite this excuse, Lawrence did not find himself back at the covert until shortly after nightfall. Having seen Temeraire snatch several large tunnies from the water, Nitidus and Dulcia expressed the inclination to try fishing themselves, and Temeraire was perfectly happy to continue demonstrating. The younger crewmen were not entirely prepared for the experience of being on board while their dragon hunted, but after the first plummeting drop had accustomed them to the experience, the startled yells vanished, and they rapidly came to view the process as a game. Lawrence found that his black mood could not survive their enthusiasm. The boys cheered wildly each time Temeraire rose up with yet another tunny wriggling in his claws, and several of them even sought permission to climb below, the better to be splashed as Temeraire made his catch. Thoroughly glutted and flying somewhat more slowly back towards the coast, Temeraire hummed in happiness and contentment, turned his head around to look at Lawrence with bright-eyed gratitude, and said, "Has this not been a pleasant day? It has been a long time since we have had such splendid flying." And Lawrence found that he had no anger left to conceal in making his reply. The lamps throughout the covert were just coming alight, like great fireflies against the darkness of the scattered trees, the ground crews moving among them with their torches even as Temeraire made his descent. Most of the younger officers were still soaking wet, and beginning to shiver as they climbed down from Temeraire's warm bulk. Lawrence dismissed them to their rest, and stood watch with Temeraire himself while the ground crew finished unharnessing him. Hollin looked at him a little reproachfully as the men brought down the neck and shoulder harnesses, encrusted with fish scales, bones and entrails, and already beginning to stink. Temeraire was too pleased and well-fed for Lawrence to feel apologetic. He only said cheerfully,
"I am afraid we have made some heavy work for you, Mr. Hollin, but at least he will not need feeding tonight."
"Aye, sir," Hollin said gloomily, and marshalled his men to the task.
The harness removed and his hide washed down by the crew, who by this time had formed the technique of passing buckets along rather like a fire brigade to clean him after his meals, Temeraire yawned enormously, belched, and sprawled out upon the ground with so self-satisfied an expression that Lawrence laughed at him.
"I must go and deliver these dispatches," he said. "Will you sleep, or shall we read this evening?"
"Forgive me, Lawrence, I think I am too sleepy," Temeraire said, yawning again. "Laplace is difficult to follow even when I am quite awake, and I do not want to risk misunderstanding."
As Lawrence had enough difficulty for his own part merely in pronouncing the French of Laplace's treatise on celestial mechanics well enough for Temeraire to comprehend without making any effort to himself grasp the principles he was reading aloud, he was perfectly willing to believe this.
"Very well, my dear. I will see you in the morning, then," he said,
and stood stroking Temeraire's nose until the dragon's eyes had slid shut, and his breathing had evened out into slumber. Admiral Lenton received the dispatches and the verbal message with frowning concern.
"I do not like it in the least, not in the least," he said. "Working inland, is he? Lawrence, could he be building more boats on shore?
planning to add to his fleet without our knowing?
Some awkward transports he might perhaps be able to make, sir, but never ships of the line, Lawrence said at once, with perfect certainty on the subject.
And he already has a great many transports in every port along the coastline. It is difficult to conceive that he might require more. And all this is around Cherbourg, not Calais, though the distance is greater, and our fleet is closer by. I cannot account for it. The gardener is quite right. I am damned sure he means mischief, and he cannot very well do it until his fleet is here.
Abruptly he stood and walked straight from the office. Unsure whether to take this as a dismissal, Lawrence followed him through the headquarters and outside, to the clearing where Lily was lying in her recovery. Captain Harcourt was sitting by Lily's head, stroking her foreleg over and over. Choiseul was with her and reading quietly to them both. Lily's eyes were still dull with pain, but in a more encouraging sign, she had evidently just eaten whole food at last, for there was a great heap of cracked bones still being cleared away by the ground crew. Choiseul put down his book and said a quiet word to Harcourt, then came to them.
"She is almost asleep. I beg you not to stir her," he said very softly.
Lenton nodded and beckoned him and Lawrence both further away.
"How does she progress?"
he asked.
"Very well, sir. According to the surgeons, they say she heals as quickly as could be hoped," Choiseul said. "Catherine has not left her side."
"Good, good," Lenton said. 3 weeks, then, if their original estimate holds true. Well, gentlemen, I've changed my mind. I'm going to send Temeraire out on patrol every day during her recovery, rather than giving him and Precursoris turn and turn about. You do not need the experience, Choiseul, and Temeraire does. You will have to keep Precursoris exercised independently."
Choiseul bowed with no hint of dissatisfaction, if he felt any.
"I am happy to serve in any way I can, sir. You need merely direct me."
Lenton nodded.
"Well, and for now, stay with Harcourt as much as ever you can. I'm sure you know what it is to have a wounded beast,"
he said. Choiseul rejoined her by the now-sleeping Lily, and Lenton led Lawrence away again, scowling in private thought.
"Lawrence," he said, "while you patrol, I want you to try and run formation manoeuvres with Nitidus and Dulcia. I know you have not been trained to small formation work, but Warren and Chennery can help you there. I want him able to lead a pair of light combatants in a fight independently, if need be."
"Very good, sir,"
Lawrence said, a little startled. He wanted badly to ask for some explanation, and repressed his curiosity with some difficulty. They came to the clearing, where Exidium was just falling asleep. Captain Rowland was speaking with her ground crewmen and inspecting a piece of the harness. She nodded to them both and came away with them. They walked back together towards the headquarters.
"Rowland, can you do without Auctoritas and Crescendium?" Lenton asked abruptly.
She lifted an eyebrow at him.
"If I have to, of course," she said. "What's this about?"
Lenton did not seem to object to being so directly queried.
"We must begin to think about sending Exidium to Cadiz once Lily is flying well," he said. "I am not going to have the kingdom lost for want of one dragon in the right place. We can hold out against aerial raids a long time here with the help of the Channel fleet and the shore batteries, and that fleet must not be allowed to escape."
If Lenton did choose to send Exidium and his formation away, their absence would leave the Channel vulnerable to aerial attack. Yet if the French and Spanish fleet escaped Cadiz and came north to join with the ships in port at Brest and Calais, perhaps even a single day of so overwhelming an advantage would be enough for Napoleon to ferry over his invasion force. Lawrence did not envy Lenton the decision. Without knowing whether Bonaparte's aerial divisions were halfway to Cadiz overland or still along the Austrian border, the choice could only be half-guess. Yet it would have to be made, if only through inaction, and Lenton was clearly prepared, instead, to take the risk. Now Lenton's design with regard to Temeraire's orders was clear. The Admiral wanted the flexibility of having a second formation on hand, even if a small and imperfectly trained one. Lawrence thought that he recalled that Auctoritas and Crescendium were middleweight combat dragons, part of Exidium's supporting forces. Perhaps Lenton intended to match them with Temeraire to make a manoeuvrable strike force of the three of them.
"Trying to outguess Bonaparte! The thought makes my blood run cold," Captain Rowland said, echoing Lawrence's sentiments. "But we will be ready to go whenever you want to send us. I will fly manoeuvres without Auctor and Cressy as time allows."
"Good! See to it," Lenton said as they climbed the stairs to the foyer.
I will leave you now. I have another 10 dispatches to read yet. More's the pity. Good night, gentlemen.
Good night, Lenton, Roland said, and stretched out with a yawn when he was gone.
Ah, well, formation flying would be deadly boring without a change about every so often, any road. What do you say to some supper?
They had some soup and toasted bread and a nice Stilton after, with port, and once again settled in Roland's room for some piquet. After a few hands and some idle conversation, she said, with the first note of diffidence he had ever heard from her,
"Lawrence, may I make so bold?"
The question made him stare, as she had never before hesitated to forge ahead on any subject whatsoever.
"Certainly," he said,
trying to imagine what she could possibly mean to ask him. Abruptly he was aware of his surroundings, the large and rumpled bed, less than 10 steps away, the open throat of her dressing gown, for which she had exchanged her coat and breeches behind a screen when they first came into the room. He looked down at his cards, his face heating. His hands trembled a little.
"If you have any reluctance, I beg you to tell me at once," she added.
"No," Lawrence said at once. "I would be very happy to oblige you, I'm sure," he added belatedly, as he realized she had not yet asked.
"You are very kind," she said,
and a wide flash of a smile crossed her face, lopsidedly, the right side of her mouth turning up more than the scarred left. Then she went on,
"And I would be very grateful if you would tell me, with real honesty, what you think of Emily's work and of her inclination for the life."
He was hard-pressed not to turn crimson at his mistaken assumption, even as she added,
"I know it is a wretched thing to ask you to speak ill of her to me, but I have seen what comes of relying too heavily upon the line of succession without good training. If you have any cause to doubt her suitability, I beg you to tell me now, while there still may be time to repair the fault."
Her anxiety was very plain now, and thinking of Rankin and his disgraceful treatment of Levitas, Lawrence could well understand it. Sympathy enabled him to recover from his self-inflicted embarrassment.
"I have seen the consequences of what you describe as well," he said, quick to reassure her. "I promise you I would speak frankly if I saw any such signs. Indeed, I should never have taken her on as a runner if I were not entirely convinced of her reliability and her dedication to her duty. She is too young for certainty, of course, but I think her very promising."
Roland blew out a breath gustily and sat back in her chair, letting her hand of cards drop as she stopped even pretending to be paying them attention.
"Lord, how you relieve me," she said. "I hoped, of course, but I find I cannot trust myself on the subject."
She laughed with relief and went to her bureau for a new bottle of wine. Lawrence held out his glass for her to fill.
"To Emily's success," he proposed.
And they drank. Then she reached out, took the glass from his hand, and kissed him. He had indeed been wholly mistaken. On this matter, she proved not at all tentative. Chapter 11 Lawrence could not help wincing at the haphazard way in which Jane threw her things out of the wardrobe and into heaps upon the bed.
"May I help you?" he asked finally, out of desperation, and took possession of her baggage. "No, I beg you, permit me the liberty. You may consider your flight path as I do this," he said.
"Thank you, Lawrence. That is very kind of you."
She sat down with her maps instead. "It will be a straightforward flight, I hope," she went on, scribbling calculations and moving the small bits of wood which she was using to represent the scattered dragon transport ships that would provide Exidium and his formation with the resting places on their way to Cadiz.
"So long as the weather holds, less than 2 weeks should see us there."
With so much urgent need, the dragons would not be going by a single transport, but rather would fly from one transport to another, attempting to predict their locations based on the current and the wind. Lawrence nodded, though a little grimly. They were only a day shy of October, and there was every likelihood at this time of year that the weather would not hold. Then she would be faced with the dangerous choice of trying to find a transport that might easily have been blown off course, or seeking shelter inland in the face of Spanish artillery, presuming, of course, that the formation was not itself brought down by a storm. Dragons were from time to time cast down by lightning or heavy winds, and if flung into a heavy ocean they could easily drown with all their crew. But there was no choice. Lily had recovered with great speed over the intervening weeks. She had led the formation through a full patrol only yesterday and landed without pain or stiffness. Lenton had looked her over, spoken a few words with her and Captain Harcourt, and gone straight away to give Jane her orders for Cadiz. Lawrence had been expecting as much, of course, but he could not help feeling concern, both for the Dragon's going and for those remaining behind. "There, that will do," she said, finishing her chart and throwing down her pen. He looked up from the baggage in surprise. He had fallen into a brown study and packed mechanically, without marking what he did. Now he realized that he had been silent for nearly 20 minutes together, and that he had one of her stays in his hands. He hastily dropped it atop the neatly packed things in her small case and closed the lid. The sunlight was beginning to come in at the window. Their time was gone. "There, Lawrence, do not look so glum. I have made the flight to Gibraltar 12 times, she said, coming to kiss him soundly. "You will have a worse time of it here, I am afraid. They will undoubtedly try some mischief once they know we are gone."
"I have every confidence in you," Lawrence said, ringing the bell for the servant. "I only hope we have not misjudged."
It was as much as he would say critical of Lenton, particularly on a subject where he could not be unbiased. Yet he felt that even if he had not had a personal objection to make to placing Exidium and his formation in danger, he would still have been concerned by the lack of further intelligence.